Okay, we are at the end of John 17, the last part there. We talked last time about the prayer that is in this section of the gospel, the prayer of Jesus to the Father. And this prayer, as we said, falls in three basic sections. Most people categorize it that way. First of all, in verses 1 through 5, Jesus prays for himself. Certainly, he's about to go through an ordeal that none of us could even imagine. And so, it is understandable that he would pray for himself. But as we talked about last time, if you look at that prayer, the prayer for himself is so that he can glorify the Father. And so, we definitely get a sense of Jesus' priority when we read that prayer. And we see that all throughout the gospel. He says, I came to do my Father's will. I came to do the will of him who sent me. So Jesus' prayer is that he has the strength and the courage, basically, to carry out that will and glorify the Father. The second part is we talked about Jesus praying for his disciples. And we mentioned that that's specifically about the 11. And I guess what will be the 12 again when we get to Acts. But for one thing, for them to be able to carry out the mission that he's about to give them. So once he's resurrected and he comes back and he's talking to them and gives them what we know as the Great Commission to go into all the world teaching and baptizing, that they need the strength to both endure Jesus' crucifixion, but also to thrive after he ascends to the Father. And he's already told them about giving them the Counselor, the Holy Spirit, and Jesus prays for them specifically. The last section, what we're going to talk about this morning, is verses 20 through 24. And this is where Jesus expands this prayer to pray for all believers. Now, the mission that Jesus is going to give the disciples is to preach to whom? To teach whom? We just said it a second ago. To all the world. Exactly right. So, Jesus is praying for all the world, at least those who are believing, those who will believe as a result of this message. And I think the idea here is it's not just those who will initially believe. Certainly, we see a great response within the book of Acts, and the Jews and the Christians of that time are going to endure another time of persecution and suffering because of rumors and friction and all types of things. But I think if we look at this prayer, we can also extend it to all believers from that point forward. So what we're seeing here then, if that's the case, is Jesus is praying for us. I mean, that's pretty significant. So let's maybe keep those things in mind as we go through these last parts here. And I think I said 20 through 24. I meant 20 through 26. So let's pick up in verse 20. I pray not only for these, the disciples, but I also pray for those who believe in me through their message. May they all be one, as you, Father, are in me and I am in you. May they also be one in us, so the world may believe you sent me. I've given them the glory you have given me. May they be one as we are one. I am in them, and you are in me. May they be made completely one, so the Father may know you have sent me and have loved them as you have loved me. Father, I desire those you have given me to be with me where I am. Then they will see my glory, which you have given me because you loved me before the world's foundation. Righteous Father, the world has not known you. However, I have known you, and these have known that you sent me. I made your name known to them and will make it known, so the love you have loved me with may be in them and I may be in them. Okay, so a few things here. First of all, again, keep this in mind in regards to us as recipients of the gospel. Anyone who is a recipient of the gospel and believes it and accepts it. But Another thing to keep in mind in this section particular, bear in mind how this section would apply to the recipients of John's gospel. What is the purpose of John's gospel as we've outlined it? John 20:31. These things are written so that you might believe. Exactly right. So this is one of those things, and it's one of those things that directly emphasizes the audience that's hearing it. So when Jesus prays for all believers, I think part of John's purpose in this is for them to feel included in the message that John is presenting. You may have other thoughts on that, but I think that you know, they can see based on Jesus' words that they have skin in the game, especially if they're enduring persecution in Ephesus at the time, in an idolatrous town. But what's kind of the word? Did you notice a word that kept getting repeated over and over again, or a thought through this particular section? Being one. Exactly right. So being one as Jesus and the Father are one. If we look through the Gospels and particularly through the New Testament and through the epistles, think about it this way. If you look at the epistles, what's one of the problems in the church that's addressed the most frequently in the epistles? Okay, factions. What do you think typically causes those factions? And again, think to the epistles. Think about some of the problems. Disbelief. Okay.
Competition.
Pride. Okay. Somebody wants authority. That's correct. Yeah. And I think a lot of those can stem from false doctrine, can't they? You got one person saying one thing, you got another person saying one thing, and we automatically have two sides butting heads. And so then pride, division, all of those things take place. What Jesus is praying for is unity, that they be one. Unity is the basis for belief. It's a specifically characterized unity, though. The same type of unity in spirit, in purpose, and in truth that Jesus shares with the Father. And again, Jesus has already said, I and the Father are one. And so this type of unity is the only means by which the world is going to come to believe in the Messiah. It's joint participation in the Father and Son unity. So, you know, Jesus speaks of His oneness with the Father and the Son. And it almost seems like whenever He says that, it's exclusive. That there's the Father and the Son, and then there's everybody else. And to a degree, that's the case. Let's be sure about that. But there's also a degree in which our unity together and the love that we express for one another brings us into that unity that the Father and the Son have. And so, again, you know, Jesus' point of emphasis throughout all of this is oneness, is unity, and that is how they're going to survive. That's how belief is going to be spread. And so Jesus says then, I desire those you have given me to be with me. So it's not just a unity of thought, it's a unity of presence that Jesus desires them to be with Him. And He's already told the disciples, I'm coming back to call you to me. So we know that He has a purpose in mind. But again, this plan for those that God has given Him to be with Him where He is first of all to those who have believed and those who will believe. And so then verse 26, again, I think this particular takes it, you know, from this point forward, all the way until Jesus returns. I made your name known to them and will make it known. Now, we could be thinking in the immediate sense of when Jesus comes back after the resurrection and he he further instructs and better informs the disciples. But there are still countless billions of people who have not known Jesus yet because they haven't existed yet. And this message is for them as well. So, you know, in particular, it makes me think of 1 Peter chapter 1. Do you remember when Peter is writing, especially if you were in the class last quarter, do you remember when Peter is writing and he says, "You have believed even though you have not seen." And Jesus even tells Thomas in just a few chapters here, "Blessed are those who believe even though they have not seen." And I think Jesus is referring to us. Peter is referring to us. That we believe based on the gospel. And so Jesus makes himself known through the gospel and through the gospel message. Any last thoughts on this? Mark, you look like you got something to say.
We were talking about how unity jumps out of these last verses that we're looking at. Some more ideas to me that jump off the page are knowledge and love.
Yes.
And we sometimes say the expression about somebody, to know them is to love them.
Yes.
The idea is that this person is so sweet and kind and gentle that if you know them, you cannot help
right.
love them.
Right.
It's an automatic response. And the love that God has for us, He had at the beginning, the reason that God created us was because He wanted to be loved. He created a race of beings with free will so they could choose willingly to love Him when they get to know Him.
Right.
And that, to me, is remarkable, that God has this desire to be loved, and He desires to have those who love Him with Him.
Yes.
In His presence, as Jesus says here, that in verse 24, that where I am, and I'm sorry, I'll just read the whole thing. Father, I desire that they also, who Thou hast given me, be with me where I am, they can see my glory.
Yes.
This is what God wants.
Yes. Yes, He does. And I think that we can see, to kind of springboard off of that point as well, and look kind of at the flip side of that coin. God does want to be loved. Now, our temptation is to think, well, God's getting everything in that. Well, yeah, He is. But think about what God wants to give as well. And that is also love. God does desire our love. He made us with the ability to love because He made us in His image. And so not only does He want us to love Him, He desires to love us in return. Maybe I shouldn't even say in return. He desires to love us. And He does. So yes, very good point. And again, all of this contributes to this oneness, this unity. 1 John, I keep referencing it. It's a preview for next quarter. But it talks about all of this. The love that we're to have for one another, the unity that we're to have with one another, and the knowledge that we're to have of Christ, of the Lord. And that is how we are known. And that's how we know that we are in the Father. So, very good point. Very good point. He is a jealous God, yes. Because He wants us so badly. And I don't think that's a bad thing. It is nice to be wanted, isn't it? Any other thoughts on 17? Okay, let's proceed to 18 then. So we pick up the narrative portion again. We've had six chapters now, give or take, of mostly dialogue. Now we pick up more with a narrative that John is telling. John 18 and 19 and 20 deal particularly with the crucifixion and the resurrection. And then 21 will be kind of the teaching and the results of the resurrection. So let's pick up with the trial this morning. Chapter 18 is all about Jesus' betrayal by Judas, and then the subsequent trial. And I'll put trial in kind of quotation marks there, as we'll plainly see. I think that we have time to read through this, so we're going to take this a section at a time. I'm sorry, I don't have a PowerPoint for this particular section. So, verse 1, after Jesus had said these things, he went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley where there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. What's this garden? It's Gethsemane. That's right. Okay. So the prayer that Jesus just prayed is before he ever made it to the garden. And then we see in the synoptics that he's praying while in the garden. So Jesus' entire plan all the way up to the cross is to pray to and rely on the Father. That's where he's getting his strength from. So there was a garden, and he and his disciples went into it. Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas took a company of soldiers and some temple police from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing everything that was about to happen to him, went out and said to them, "Who is it that you're looking for?" "Jesus the Nazarene," they answered. "I am he," Jesus told them. Judas, who betrayed them, was also standing with them. When he told them, "I am he," they stepped back and fell to the ground. Then he asked them again, "Who is it that you're looking for?" "Jesus the Nazarene," they said. "I told you I am he," Jesus replied. "So if you're looking for me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the words he had said, "I have not lost one of those you have given me." Let's pause here and kind of extrapolate this a little bit. As we're reading through 18 and as we're looking at these events, we've talked throughout John about how Jesus is in full control of events. And I think one of the best ways that we see that happening is throughout the process that's going to take place in 18. Throughout his betrayal and his trial before the high priest and Pilate. In all the ways that Jesus acts and responds, he is in full control of events, even if it looks to the contrary. So, the question then that I have to ask, first of all, even in just the description of the place that Jesus is, there was a garden and he and his disciples went into it. Jesus often met there with his disciples. How does the description of this place contribute to the fact that Jesus is in full control of events? He's going to Gethsemane. This is a place that he's comfortable with. Right. Okay, yes. Let's back up just a little bit. Why even just the location is a sign that Jesus is in control? That's one big thing. He's not hiding. He's in a place where he knew that Judas would find him. Exactly right. Who chose this location? Jesus did, right? There wasn't anybody going to decide where all these events took place. Only Jesus was in control. So Jesus has specifically chosen the location that he will be arrested, and the arrest takes place on his terms. And he feels a certain level of comfort with this place and knows that Judas is going to find him there, as Mike said, and he's not hiding. That's a very good observation. He is waiting for events to play out. Jesus, verse 4, then Jesus, knowing everything that was about to happen. And that's in the immediate sense and from that point forward. Okay, so then Judas comes out with this company of soldiers. And yours might say a cohort of soldiers or a detachment of soldiers. Cohort is an interesting word because cohort is actually a military term to describe a certain number of soldiers. It's a sixth of a legion, which is 6,000, or I'm sorry, a tenth of a legion, which is 6,000 soldiers. If if a cohort is a sixth of that, we're talking at least or up to 600 soldiers to bring in a carpenter from Galilee. Just an interesting. Now, it may not be that many. I mean, that it may just be a word used to describe a detachment. But nonetheless, more than two soldiers. Or maybe if they had one soldier for each of the disciples, that would probably be enough. But, you know, and the fact that Roman soldiers are among them. This is not just the temple guard. So the Sanhedrin seems to have already consulted Pilate on this matter to at least get the authority to arrest Jesus. Again, we come to this detail that he provides us about Jesus, that he knows everything that's about to happen to him. Jesus is the one person here that has a complete understanding of the situation. He's not being taken unwillingly. He's not being taken by surprise. He even takes the initiative to engage the soldiers. Does he wait for them to get there and start asking who they're looking for? No, he asks, who is it that you're looking for? He initiates contact. Wouldn't we be tempted to just kind of stand back and wait to see what's going to happen, even if we know what it's about to happen? It's interesting to note maybe some of the details that are missing in this as well. In John's account, Jesus' identity is given because Jesus specifically gives it. In the synoptics, how is it that they learn of Jesus' identity, of which one they were there for? The kiss, the Judas kiss, exactly right. John omits this detail. And there's going to be quite a few details, actually, that the synoptics give us that John does not. But again, when you're reading through this, consider how even the omission of those details contributes to John's purpose in writing. So Jesus is in full control. And so then he asks them, who you're looking for? They say, Jesus the Nazarene. And Jesus says what? I am. Now, I am he is technically the sense. It's kind of the general sense of it. But I am. Now, haven't we seen that all throughout John? Jesus consistently saying, I am, and using that form of it. So within that is a pronunciation of not only am I Jesus, but I am everything that goes with this. And we see the reaction. They cannot stand in his presence. Just as Moses was forced to shy back from the burning bush, and God told him to take off his sandals because this was holy ground, these soldiers, at least for a moment, cannot stand in the presence of Jesus. They are forced either to their knees or to the ground. It honestly makes me think of Romans, where it says when Jesus returns, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. This is just a foreshadowing of that. Some speculated that they can't stand in the face of Jesus' moral superiority. Others have speculated that his calm demeanor and commanding presence have unnerved the soldiers, and so they just kind of faint or, you know, kind of wither a little bit. I don't know specifically, but there's something about this that they can't stand in his presence. And so Jesus says, if you're looking for me, let these men go. So even at the point where he's about to be taken and he knows everything that's going to happen, he's still thinking about his disciples. His first priority is to them. And it says, verse 9, this was to fulfill the words he had said, I have not lost one of those you have given me. And we saw that in chapter 17, verse 12, that I haven't lost anyone and I desire that I don't lose anyone. So this request is only found in John. The other Gospels, particularly Mark, seem to indicate that the disciples escaped from the garden because they fled. Mark's account even mentions that one of them fled right out of his clothes because he was so anxious to get away. But here, Jesus has control over whether or not they are allowed to leave the garden. And then they flee. So again, Jesus is in full control. And we're going to keep saying this over and over again. So then we get Peter's reaction. Verse 10. Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's servant, and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. At that, Jesus said to Peter, "Sheathe your sword. Am I not to drink the cup the Father has given me?" Then the company of soldiers, the commander, and the Jewish temple police arrested Jesus and tied him up. First, they led him to Annas, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was advantageous that one man should die for the people. So, of all the people in Jesus' little group of soldiers, little band of people, who's got a sword? Peter's got a sword. Would you have given Peter a sword if you knew you were going into a powder keg? I mean, maybe I would have been more tempted to keep it away from James and John, considering their proclivities to wanting to strike people down with lightning or fire from heaven. But Peter probably would have been the very next one I wouldn't have given it to, especially because he said, "I will go down and die with you. I will not leave you." So Peter, although there's a certain level of, I mean, let's just call it what it is, stupidity in this, there's a certain amount of bravery in this as well. Let's say this cohort is at least, let's just say 50 soldiers. Are you going to draw your sword? You, a fisherman from Galilee, are you going to draw your sword against 50 trained soldiers of the greatest empire the world has ever seen? I wouldn't. And yet Peter does. So despite the lack of wisdom in this decision, Simon Peter is brave, and he loves Jesus. He loves Jesus. You can see that. And so the first person he strikes out against is known as the high priest's servant. Now, I don't think this is somebody that's like wiping floors and things like this. I think that actually this is the person who is leading this group. He is essentially the person that answers directly to the high priest, and that is Malchus. Now, it says he cut off Malchus's ear. What do you think was really the intent that Peter was going for? He was going to take off a whole lot more than an ear, right? And he just kind of happened to miss. I mean, Malchus probably dodged and the sword, you know, swiped his ear. Now we don't get the account in John of Jesus healing Malchus at that point. So Malchus is kind of one of those interesting people that we don't get the rest of the story. What did he think from that point forward, especially after Jesus healed him? Did he continue to go along with this? Well, I just always think that's interesting to think about. But it seems apparent that Peter was aiming for his neck and he missed. But Jesus' response to him then, his rebuke, "Am I not to drink the cup the Father has given me?" And you know, in the other accounts of Gethsemane, what was Jesus' prayer to the Father? "I pray that you" what? "That you let this cup pass from me, but nonetheless your will be done and not mine. I pray that you let this cup pass from me." So if we keep that in mind, this makes more sense to us. Now, Jesus has talked in John about the cup with which he is to, that he's to drink in this situation. But Jesus' rebuke of Peter here shows two things, I think. The first is that he is still aware of the necessity of his suffering. It's been consistent in his message all throughout. And even in the way that John the Baptist described him when he came onto the scene, the Lamb of God, Jesus knows that he must be sacrificed for the people. But also that he's still committed to the Father's plan. That he knows what it is and he is committed to going to the cross. So he knows these things and he's ready to go through with them. Now, from this point, he is taken. He goes to Annas. And only John's gospel includes the meeting with Annas. Annas was appointed high priest by the Romans in 6 AD. He was then deposed in 15 AD by the Roman procurator Gratus. But even after his deposition, considering the year that we're in is anywhere between 30 to 35 AD, even though he was no longer the high priest, he still exerted tremendous influence over the office. And I'll tell you why. After he was deposed, the next four high priests were Annas' sons. They ruled over a period of 3 years. So not only was there severe nepotism going on here, it was volatile. After these four sons reigned as high priest, and I'll use the term reigned as opposed to serving, that's when Caiaphas came onto the scene. Now, who is Caiaphas in relation to Annas? His son-in-law. Okay. Now, we talk about today kind of good old boy politics. We're seeing that in action here. I had something to read about this. We don't have time to read through this, but basically, Annas was about as corrupt as they get. The high priesthood at this point is appointed by the Romans. It's not a lifetime office from the Jews. It has nothing to do with the law except in name only. The Romans are appointing these people, and they're specifically people that can provide the amount of money to bribe the Romans into keeping them in office until such a time as they do something that is kind of against the grain, and then they can just be removed like that. So when John uses the phrase, and he's used it before in the gospel, Caiaphas was high priest that year, that description is almost a dig at the high priests. That year he was high priest, but there's coming a year when he's not going to be again. another thing about Annas, you remember when Jesus was in the temple courtyard and he overturned the money changers' tables? We only get one instance of it in John at the beginning of the gospel. But in the other gospels, we have another account of it at the end, shortly before these events take place, don't we? Now, an interesting detail that I found kind of in my research is this marketplace, marketplace outside the temple was often known as Annas's Bazaar because the animals that the people brought for sacrifice, what condition did they have to be in? What's that? They had to be spotless. Exactly right. Okay. So someone comes to Jerusalem from outside. They're bringing their animal, which they have deemed spotless. Now they present it for inspection. In a corrupt society, what do you think happens at that inspection? They're going to find there's a spot here. There's a this foot looks a little crooked, or his beak is not perfect, or this horn is not. So they're going to find an imperfection. Well, what do you do if you get to Jerusalem and your sacrifice is imperfect? You got to find some way to sacrifice, right? How convenient that there is sacrifice marked here, that you can just walk up and provide. However, because of the convenience charge, you're going to be paying a premium. So when Jesus talks about turning his Father's house into a marketplace, the level of corruption that is in play here is just unfathomable. And how did God let them stand? So Jesus' anger is certainly justified. So that's Annas in a nutshell. Okay? So Jesus comes before Annas. What I want to do is we kind of have two intermingled stories here. We have the story of Peter and his denial interspersed with the trial with Annas. So what I want to do is I want to cover one and then the other. So we're kind of going to be chopping up the text a little bit, but they do mesh together. So the trial with Annas picks up in verse 19. And what's interesting is, how is Annas described in verse 19? Because that's who we're talking about here. How is he described? As the high priest. Well, Annas was deposed at least 12 years prior to these events. So how could he be the high priest? I think what we're seeing is the influence he has over that office. So the high priest questioned Jesus about the disciples and his teaching. Now, if the Jews had already determined to kill Jesus, we've seen that in multiple places, why do you think Annas is questioning him? What's the point of this questioning? I mean, it's kind of a foreordained thing at this point. So why is he questioning him? What's that? Exactly right. Additional evidence. He's trying to find something in what Jesus is going to say. Because notice what he questions him about. It says he questioned him about his disciples and about his teaching. So he's either going to try to discredit the disciples based on their character, or he's going to discredit Jesus' teaching based on what's in it. He's going to try to find some word or concept to be able to justify what it is that they want to do. Because he can't just send Jesus to Pilate and say, hey, we don't like this guy. Can you? I mean, they're going to try that here in just a second. But Pilate's going to ask for evidence. Annas needs to find something that he can accuse Jesus of. And so he questions Jesus about the disciples and his teaching. Jesus' response, though, is perfect. I have spoken openly to the world. I have always taught in the synagogue and in the temple complex where all the Jews congregate, and I haven't spoken anything in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who heard what I told them. Look, they know what I said. So there's a couple things in play here. First of all, based on Jesus' response here, I think it's also possible that Annas was trying to delve some sort of secret kind of cult teaching that Jesus had. That he would teach one thing in public, but then he would go behind closed doors and be growing pockets of dissension and rebellion. So Annas is trying to get to the bottom of this and figure out what Jesus was teaching. And Jesus says, hey, everything I said, public or private, I said in the temple. All you got to do is question those who heard me. There's another thing that's in play here, though. In the Old Testament, when you were bringing somebody, especially for a capital offense, what are the circumstances under which they could be executed? Two or three witnesses. Exactly right. Two or three witnesses. So Jesus is effectively saying, call your witnesses. I don't see any witnesses here. Call your witnesses. And the thing is that in Jesus' response, especially verse 23, this response continues. After he's slapped by the temple police for perceived insubordination. And they say, is this the way you answer the high priest? Which, first of all, this ain't the high priest. But secondly, if I have spoken wrongly, Jesus says, give evidence about the wrong. But if rightly, why do you hit me? Why do you strike me? So Jesus says, I don't see any witnesses. You have no basis under which to either execute me or even abuse me. So Jesus is not afraid of what these witnesses could say either. Even if the witnesses came, he's not afraid of their testimony. He knows what he said and they know what he said. Even the ones that disagree with him. So I'll tell you what, let's finish up this morning with the trial with Annas, and then we'll cover Peter's denial and the trial with Pilate the next time. Annas, not being able to find anything wrong, apparently, where does he send him? He sends him to Caiaphas. Exactly right. The actual high priest at the time. Okay? Now, if you've kind of read forward in John 18, do we have any of that conversation? Spoiler, no, we don't. Now, in the synoptics, do we get that conversation? Yeah, we get it in pretty vivid detail. So it's interesting that John includes a character that was not in the other Gospels, but that character wields influence and authority over all the rest of the characters. So Jesus is more powerful than Annas, and we're going to see he is more powerful than Pilate. Because Pilate is going to grow increasingly frustrated with the fact that he can't just sweep this thing away. And the thing is that Pilate sets himself up for it too. Because the Jews tried to get Pilate to just sign the death warrant and move on with it. You know, if we hadn't brought this guy before you, you know, we brought him before you, he's got to be a criminal, right? Can you just sign the paper and we'll all move on with this? But Pilate says, I don't see any evidence yet. What charges are you going to bring? So Pilate's setting himself up. We might be able to cover Peter's denial very quickly because John doesn't talk about it in significant detail. A couple of details about Peter's denial. First of all, Peter is outside the temple complex. How is it that he gains entrance from the text? Very quickly. Okay, one of the apostles intercedes on his behalf to allow him entrance. Who do you think this apostle or disciple is based on the text? Especially because he's unnamed. It's probably John. I mean, we see John pop up in other parts of the crucifixion narrative. So most likely it's him. Now, what's interesting about this is Peter starts denying association with Jesus. Remember, the first question that's asked in this particular narrative is, you're not one of his disciples too, are you? And one of the details we get about the disciple that gave him entrance was, it was known that he was an associate of Jesus. So when Peter denies Jesus, not only, and most significantly, is he denying association with Jesus, who else is he distancing himself from? From John. The very person who allowed him entrance from the cold to let him stand by a fire and listen to everything that's going on. So those little details here, we're seeing Peter kind of going through a descent into denial. So we have Peter's three denials. We're well familiar with these. We have Peter's three denials. And the last two of which pick up in verse 25 and 26. And one of those, as John tells us in verse 26, is a relative of Malchus. And he even says, not only was a relative, but he was at the garden when Jesus was arrested. And he says, didn't I see you with him in the garden? Peter then denies it again. And what happens? The third denial, what happens right after that? The rooster crows. Now, who told us that was going to happen? Jesus did. Exactly right. 13:38. Jesus said, the rooster will not crow before you have denied me three times. Not me, Lord. Never. I will die with you. And we see at one point that he was willing to. So what's interesting about this to me is not only is this a descent of Peter into denial, I think Peter doesn't know what to do with what he's seeing. And this is speculation on my part. I'm fully willing to admit this. But as I've tried to think through, how did Peter go from this point to this point? And I think that there's a sense, and you may agree with me or not, in which Peter thinks, I don't know who Jesus is. I don't understand how he could be the Messiah and give himself up like this. And so, for him to say, I don't know Jesus, there's a certain level of truth to that. He doesn't fully know Jesus yet, but he's about to. And we're going to see more about that next time. So we'll pick up with this part of the narrative, especially with Pilate's trial next time, and then go into 19 with the crucifixion. Thank you.